We'll just say welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here, and look forward to seeing what unfolds in today's conversation and just what direction we go in. And the objective for me of presenting this enlightenment book, Kabbalah, is to do the best I can to convey the possibilities of living in, of developing and living in an Aramaic mindset. Now, I'd suggest today I was going to move into reading a couple of chapters of a book that I started 20-some years ago after having the insight that when Yeshua said, and they asked him what's most important in the law, and he said, you must not love your neighbor, love God as yourself, but he said you must have rachma. And it's interesting, that word rachma, we were out in California, this is several years ago, I was traveling with a manuscript, we were working on getting high-resolution digital images made, and there was a group in Southern California that spoke Aramaic as their native language. And we went and visited with them, and we were asking them about this word rachma. And they said that the definition had been lost, the original definition, but there was a tradition that went with the word. And the tradition was that it was the most incredible, important, beautiful, valuable jewel that you could possess. And when you realize that that single word is what the 11 most important words ever spoken were about, then you can get why, even though they didn't quite understand what it was, that was the tradition. And again, the insight that I got that fired me writing this book, The End of Suffering, was that the passage that came after he said, have rachma, when you think of the creator, when you think of neighbor, and by so doing you maintain self, or in order to maintain self, he then says, for upon this, upon rachma, hangs the law and all its prophets. And it is a condition in the mind that is the gateway that brings love, our created essence, human life, into our human forms. And so, if you're going to pick up any scriptures, I don't care what religion it's in, or pick up anything, most people think that they're reading words on a page and the meanings that the author had for those words. Few people realize that in every event in their lives, they're not experiencing what the other, let's say in the course of a book, they're not experiencing what the author's written. They're experiencing what their mind interprets the author has written. The words that the author uses trigger certain brain cells in an individual, and an individual forms a construct, forms perception out of that interaction of energy. And so recognizing that everybody literally, you know, like, why, when, really, the teachings of Yeshua, you go back and read them, they're pretty clear, especially when you get to them in the Aramaic. How is it possible that there are approximately 32,000 different sects all professing that they have the truth about what Yeshua said? What I'm offering is that each of them has the perceptual construct that his words resonated in them. And because the perceptual construct of Joe is different from Harry, is different from Mary, is different from Hortense, everybody goes off and says, I have the truth. We're not going to pretend we have the truth, but we have worked diligently, individually and collectively, the people who've worked on this manuscript project, to do our own work, to arrive at a point where we can at least get some pointers on what was originally said in the Aramaic language. And from that, rather than standing up and proclaiming, oh, this is it, this is the way, it's like, no, here are the tools. The man presented tools. In essence, he presented tools with which to open this gateway in your mind. That's the whole bottom line of it. You know, you hear him saying, I come to bring you life, not dogma, not doctrine, not a theology that's going to beat every other theology in the world, but simply, I come to bring you life. And opening the gateway in the mind for life, for our created essence to show up in our physiology, is the whole bottom line of it. And the work is that of undoing, well, actually, the Course in Miracles says it really beautifully. You need not seek for love. You need only seek, find, and release the barriers you built within yourself against it. That's the bottom line of the work. When you remove everything from your physiology, and the word that represents the removal of energetic patterns from your physiology is forgiveness, when you remove everything that's unlike the truth of who you are, and Rachma is set, then you get to experience who you are. And you can only have that experience. Nobody can tell you about it. They can inspire you to have the experience, but you've got to have the experience. And part of achieving that experience is removing from the mind those things that never belonged, that through resonance tend to come up to block awareness. Again, of course, you need not seek for love. You need only seek, find, and I add the, and release the barriers, the realities that come up and overwrite or overpower your experience of yourself as love. And that means that part and parcel of that is going to be that you're going to get to experience energetic patterns in yourself. You're going to get to embrace those patterns, and you're going to get to heal those patterns. So part of the objective of the work is to convey a state of being, a mindset that allows us to embrace ourselves in love that block us from experiencing ourselves as love. And I share that because this is, you know, one of the objectives of this work is to empower each person to have a personal experience, personally experienced, to do the work of the direct experience of who you are as a human being, not a picture in your mind of your body and what that means, but truly to experience yourself as who you are. And so this book started out, as I shared, in a Laws of Living class. For me, it was like a major, probably one of the biggest insights I've gotten from Laws of Living was the import of those words, for upon this hangs the law and all its prophets. So I started to write a book, The 11 Most Important Words Ever Spoken. As I was writing it, I had an experience come up. I had a major piece of work as I'm focused, I'm totally keyed in and focused to the, in this writing and working to convey, working to use words that would be as precise as possible so that people could read it and we could at least convey the tools and the understanding of what Yeshua was speaking about. And as I was writing, and this is what changed the title of the book from The 11 Most Important Words Ever Spoken to The End of Suffering. And that is that as I was writing, I touched into a major event in my life that was one of the blocks to me experiencing myself as who I was. It was a circumstance, it was a situation in which I experienced a great deal of suffering as a kid. What was suffering for me? And the memory that I had surface was a memory of being, I'm not even sure exactly what age. I might have been four, I might have been six, I might have been seven. And I'm writing, and all of a sudden I have this memory surface. Now, my history, when I was in utero, the last 6 days, my mother had toxemia. They gave her Pitocin to try to get me out. They called my father at the hospital the night of my birth and said, if you want to see this kid alive, you better get down here because he's not going to make it through the night. So that was kind of my history. And from there, from what my mother shares, I almost died four or five times the first year of my life. And frantically, she shared with me one day her mother came to visit her, and she handed the baby over to her mother. Mother said, and I was having trouble breathing. Mother, your baby's dying, and off to the hospital we go. But the memory that surfaced that I had to process through as I was writing this, that it was like the writing of this created a context for me in which I was able to, you know, a combination of things, be open to allowing this memory to surface, be empowered enough to embrace the trauma of this memory. But I'm not sure exactly what age it was, four, five, six, seven, something like that. And I'm in my bedroom, laying on the bed. I've been in bed for, I don't know how long, I've been in the middle of an asthma attack. And from my bedroom, I can look through the door and I can see the bathroom door. This is in the home I lived in when I was a kid. And I desperately need to go to the bathroom. But because of the fact that I can't breathe, I don't have enough energy to get out of bed and get to the bathroom. And I was able to embrace that experience and recognize the load that I was writing this book 20 years ago. So I'd been carried this load for several decades from being a kid of what for me as a kid presented itself as some pretty severe suffering. Hopelessness, helplessness, I can't even go to the bathroom. I can't even stand up. I don't have enough breath to move to the other side of the room to walk through that door. And that's when the title of the book moved from the 11 most important words ever spoken to the end of suffering, because this man, Yeshua, brought a set of tools. Now, unfortunately, there are many cases where people who are purportedly teaching his work inflict suffering on themselves and others. But in fact, what he came to do was to put an end to suffering. And so this book title changed, and the direction of the book, the whole idea of the book, is much like Why Is This Happening to Me Again, where in that book I'm having a conversation with this character named Richard. In this book, Yeshua is having a conversation with a character who's unnamed. It's interesting. I was traveling a lot at the time I was writing this, and I was had been scheduled to go to a conference where they were introducing different authors to book representatives. And Why Is This Happening to Me Again had been out there. It was pretty successful. They tell me that a successful self-published book is 3,000 to 5,000 copies, and I was at about 70,000 at that point. And so a couple of the representatives were pretty excited. Hey, we want to represent your next work. I was like, great. And I had two chapters of this book finished, so I arranged to send the two chapters to them. And it was, at least my conclusion, was that the material being presented was so challenging to them that neither of them ever communicated with me again. Neither of them returned my phone calls. They were both very excited. We want your work. But never heard from either of them again. So that's kind of the context of this book. And the reason I share it is I invite you to come on the journey with me of getting into the space of safety, of listening. And I'll offer, this is not translation that I'm offering here. My sense of Yeshua, how Yeshua would speak to one of us today, in terms of moving us in the direction of being able to embrace whatever it is that we are suffering over, whatever it is that we project into our brain's image of someone else. How to embrace that directly rather than projecting our own self-inflicted trauma or self-inflicted nonsense, sin, into our brain's image of other people and always having a conversation about how it's always their fault. So the first chapter, well, before I step into reading the first chapter, Ms. Jeannie, do we have any questions or thoughts at this point before we move forward?
No hands up, and
okay.
Bob's in the chat room, and I asked him how he was doing, and he says, very good, he's busy researching prostate cancer, ha, ha, ha. Oh, a hand just went up.
Holding the space,
Bob.
Bob
holds
for...
you in their hearts.
Yes.
And happy Valentine's
Day. So you got a hand up, sweetie?
Everybody. I do.
Oh, happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Presence of love.
So it's Miss Celinda 541. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Welcome, young lady.
Oh,
how are you today?
Probably, it's probably afternoon for you, isn't it?
It is.
I can't keep up. That's all right. I live in
which just proves
time.
The illusion of time.
There you go.
It's a good fantasy, man, but it's a fantasy all the same.
Yep, you got it, sir. a couple of things. One thing is Rachma. Because I have studied the meridian system, and so many of the emotional states are connected to certain organs of the meridian system, I was hoping that you could give me a clue about Rachma, especially in the light of Molecules of Emotion by Candace Pert. If you could give me a clue or a sense of Rachma in relation to the pineal gland, sir. And you're a sir today, dear heart, for whatever reason.
Say it again. I'm a what?
A sir today.
Oh, okay.
S-I-R.
Sir Galahad.
There you go. That'll work.
Okay. So I'm not sure if your question is, are we asking in relationship to where would Rachma be physically in the in the structure?
Where that transition point, like with Candace Pert, when she talks about the emotions being energy, and then at some point they become neuropeptides, is there like a gateway for Rachma? Who is the gateway, or which is the gateway anyway, to the one mind, opening it up? Is there something in reference to the pineal gland that would have any connection of that, a la Candace Pert's The Molecules of Emotion?
Right. Great book. I knew Candace. She loved this work. And she was a sweetie. I mean, she was just... so far ahead of her time. In any event, and we'll hold her in a blessing. I was shocked a few years back when she passed away. Didn't expect that.
Well, you know what? She's right here with us, Michael.
There you go. So in terms of a quote-unquote physical location, I don't know whether it would make sense to me that it would be related to the pineal gland, that might be the actual, what we call the physical location, the energetic location of that filter. Also, if you do some reading about the angular gyrus, that's another place I suspect he might have been referring to in using the word, or that the language would have referred to using the word Rachma. And I don't know that we'll ever figure that out. However, you know, the real purpose of having an idea about it is that I make it a primary directive for me to maintain that, so that wherever physiologically we might be able to locate this filter or this gateway, that we keep it open so that The whole system is fueled literally on a cellular level by love. To me, that's the objective, is that if we are separated from, if we shut that down, then the energy system's on its own and it winds down and it dies. But rather to move out of entropy, the winding down, because we're cut off from that source, is to keep it open and keep that flow of active present love moving through us, so that we move into ectopy rather than entropy. In other words, we're continuously moving into higher and higher states of organization rather than breaking down into lower and lower states when we're disconnected. But they'd be my best two guesses. I would think the pineal or the what's called the angular gyrus seems to have characteristics from what I've researched.
The angular gyrus and how you would spell it.
I believe it's G-Y-R-U-S. Angular, like, you know, left angle, right angle, angular.
Well, this is really fascinating because I've both, because of my yoga training and because I've been interested in Tai Chi and Qigong, I'm from the Buddhist and the Touch for Health, by the way. Touch for Health is a standard for me.
Good stuff.
And I like this simple book. I am not interested in all of the complicated complications of the new book that the son presented after John Thee died. But that's the
thing. Oh, that's okay.
I just find simple
we'll let that
is
go.
Good for me. Yeah, right.
Yep.
It's just that simple is good for me. Not that it should be good for everyone. But anyway, in the chakra system, the pineal gland is like right at the thousand petal lotus. So that, and that is the crown, which is ready to connect to the infinite, which is above the energy that's above the body system. So I just.
The power plug.
Power plug. There you go, sir. Are you plugged in or not?
Yeah.
So somehow there is a sense within me that all of those things are somehow related to each other. So I thought I would share that with you. And
maybe
ask.
Be my best input. Either one of those would be my best input, and neither one may be accurate, but.
We don't know that, but that's not what we're about, right? Knowing. That's the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. It's
use
about
the tools.
The practice. Use the tools. Now,
use
I have
the
couple,
tools.
Two,
that's
other,
it.
Two other things that I wanted to share with you. I think I said this on Dr. Tim's show, but this is for Susan and Magda, in case they're listening, and for all of us, including me. When I said that sometimes I'm not really experiencing that this other person is love. But, and at the same time, walking through the middle of the neutrality of all events, I'm staying in the middle when I choose consciously to say the word sweetheart, dear one, all of these terms of endearment like you and Jeannie say and Dr. Tim when he says you're welcome and deserving. And what I find, what I'm finding in my practice is that it is having a softening effect on me, my allowance and surrender and willingness to be who I am in the present moment with all of my baggage, resistance, whatever, and say the gentle things, like Sylvia Boorstein says, you know, okay, sweetheart, now be gentle with yourself. And I'm finding it has an outer-inner effect. It's a two-way swinging door.
For sure.
And,
and
with all of this, Michael and Jeannie, I have been able to, after a year of struggling with this deep friendship with a friend of mine over COVID issues, that I felt like I'd walked into a landmine and now understand how I could have created my 50% just as well, and did, in fact, through my naivete and assumptions and a putting somebody else more important than source. And so I thought I would just share all that. I am now clear. I've cleared the deck in that situation, and now I am ready to talk with her and just share my experience and my journey into healing and hopes that we can continue our relationship in a totally transformed way.
Well, we'll hold the space. I'd offer one piece of feedback.
Yes.
When you speak about your 50%, I'd invite you to consider upping that number to your 100%, because whatever the response was of your mind, your mind's construct, your reality, is 100% yours. Nothing to do with her, except she happens to be the stimulus for it. But it's 100% yours. And if I were talking to her, if she said, well, I'll take my 50%, I'd say, well, I suggest you put your number up to 100, because it's the output of her mind if there's disturbance in her, and the output of yours if there's disturbance in you, and the output of mine if there's disturbance in me. And to me, what Yeshua came to bring us was a very practical set of tools for how to take responsibility for that disturbance, recognize when we've shut that gateway called Rachma, and reopen it and embrace directly, rather than putting it into our brain's image of someone else, embrace directly whatever our suffering is about in the presence of that active love, which is the master solvent for dissolving or forgiving, removing those energetic patterns.
Thank you.
So just invite you to consider upping that.
No, I'm happy to consider it, because it just shifts the perspective in the perfect way for me, because I am aspiring toward the 100% responsibility for my creative power.
Yay.
And also 100%, that's my journey, 100% accountability for the effects that I have on someone else. So with those two factors, I really appreciate that input. Yeah, that's very helpful.
Cool.
You know, the world talks about 50-50, so it's just realigning myself to the target, more in alignment with the bullseye, right?
That would be my take. My take is when I want to say, well, they've got their 50%, I want to keep my left foot in the one world universal religion of blame, and I want to keep my right foot in the universal or possibly universal religion of experiencing ourselves as the active presence of love. That, you know, I still want to be able to say, well, they're 50%. It's like, no, they have no liability or responsibility whatsoever for what comes up in me, even though they may be the trigger for it. I have to embrace that wholeheartedly in order to, and directly, rather than putting it to my brain's image of them, if I'm ever going to heal.
And what's really sweet is this experience of committing to and focusing on walking the middle path, the middle way.
Yes.
Because it's so sweet to have that whole rainbow of possibilities, instead of being the chicken with its beak on the white line, that's all it can see is its truth. It's and helping to disengage my little mental fingers away from I'm right. And so I keep going back to that kind of a 12-step mantra where it says, would you rather be right or would you rather be love? Only they say, oh, would you rather love? I change it to be love.
Yeah, I'm with you. I didn't know that was in the 12-step work. I know that's in Course in Miracles. That's the source I'm aware of for that statement, but it's cool if it's in the 12-step as well. Awesome.
It's just one of those little sayings, you know, that they come up with, the mantras. Yeah, it's not really in the book, probably. Okay, perfect. Thank you, sir.
All right, young lady, you have a blessing.
I am complete. All right.
Okay, I'll pull up.
And we do have another hand up, but Melinda, we did get the books yesterday.
Oh,
yes, for Aria. Thank you.
I just hope that even if the languaging isn't quite correct, that Aria and you have your relationship where you can guide her through them in an interpretation, because I have a lot of respect for Julie Andrews.
Well, we'd have to read them to her because it's beyond her capacity right now, but thank you very much.
Yeah, and she'll love the Wang Doodle and the Wiffle Bird, and that's one of my nicknames for myself is the Wiffle Bird. So good luck.
Okay. All right.
Thanks.
Cool.
All right.
Have a blessed one.
Bye.
Okay, and Bob from Australia is on. Your hands up. Welcome, Bob.
Good morning. Good morning, you beautiful people.
How do you be, young man? Embracing you in our hearts.
It's 4:35 in the a.m. here, and just about to witness another beautiful day dawning here in paradise. And what I love about this time of day, the world is so silent. You know, it's mystical and magical. How am I?
Right.
Many happy returns, by the way. It's somebody's recently had a birthday, I believe.
Yesterday was my eternal day.
Yeah, well, many happy returns, my friend. Life's kind of interesting for me at the moment. My appointment book is all full of medical visits and not one dinner date, which is quite quite disappointing. But I had some good news the other day. My colonoscopy results are all clear, so that's good. But I still got my prostate results to come, and I get them in about 8 hours, 10 hours time. So I've been busy researching prostate cancer, and but for me, where I'm coming from, it's like, okay, Bob, you create this event in your life. What is the lesson you need to learn from this?
Right.
And it's like for me, the universe is saying, Bob, this is a call to arms, if you like. It's time to put up or shut up. Do you go with your this life experience programming and go the Western medical model, or do you go with your knowing of like nature is nurture and let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food? So it's like forcing me to make that decision. And from the research I've done, I'm not really worried about the outcome. However, it is described by Western medicine. I have a whole catalogue of natural remedies, in my back pocket, and I've actually started my own sort of treatment protocols with chlorine dioxide, and I'm seeing amazing results in the rest of my body already. So. That's all good. Yeah, so it's a
awesome.
Funny time. It's a funny time. And
get your attention.
It's like I'm learning a lot going through this process. Like, and again, this is just the data I'm getting from the Western medical model. Like 10% of all people that get prostate cancer die. And that's just a numbers game. But of the 90% remaining, there is no benefit in going through surgery. There's no improvement in longevity or quality of life. And it's made me focus on the concept of cancer and tumors. My mum had bowel cancer when I was 16, and she had, a colostomy. But it's like Western medicine goes in and cuts out the tumor and thinks, well, that's it, we've done our bit. But my question is, and again, it seems to be the primary focus of Western medicine is focused on dealing with the symptoms and
yes.
wanting to go for the cure. But my question is, well, what caused that naughty little cell not to die when it was supposed to, it's funny, and this may sound harsh, but I've come to the realization that I'm in a system whereby you mentioned cancer and everybody's frightened. There's a big fear there. And people are making choices from that place of fear to go
right.
through all these procedures. Now, all these procedures make money for somebody. And it's, yeah, it's like the bottom line that I've come up with is curing people is not good for business. And I find that
right.
very sad. Yeah. Yeah. It's very
yep,
sad.
Some money in it.
Yeah.
You know, basically, big pharma is about creating customers, not cures. You know,
yeah,
they don't. There's no research done to cure anything. There's research done to find treatments, which people then will be paying for the rest of their lives, basically. And in naturopathic medicine, the system I'm trained in, a tumor is the body's defense mechanism where it's taking all the toxic energies that it can't otherwise process out of the body and putting them in one place and building a wall around it to protect itself from it. It's really not the enemy. And do you have access? You're calling into the show. I'm not sure how. Do you have access to make phone calls to Canada?
Through Skype, yeah.
Okay. Well, I have a brother who, I'm not even sure exactly how long ago, they found him about somewhere around 10 years ago at a fairly advanced stage and told him he better do this, and or he would die. And he said, well, thank you very much, but I'll pass. And he didn't do any of it. At one stage, I believe about 2 years ago, he did some medical procedures that he had previously not done, but he's rocking 10 years later when they told him, I think he had about 2 years, and he's gone totally a natural route. He works with a naturopath up there, and if you'd like, I'll be glad to, you know, text you or email you his phone number if you want to talk to him and, you know, just get his experience, what he's done, because he's just rocking and doing well.
Yeah,
and they told him he'd be gone a long time ago.
Yeah, I would love that. But also,
okay.
I found a great resource on YouTube, and there's a channel there called The Patient's Story, and it's all about lived experience, and it's all about cancer, all cancers. But they have a playlist there for prostate cancer, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of video testimonies of people just saying precisely that. You know, don't go under the knife. Take control. Thank the doctor for, who is after all a contractor. You know, I employ the doctor to give me information. But take control of your own well-being and listen to your heart, you know. You know, and it's the same with this, you know, my mission to eradicate suicide. It's the same thing there. It's people's programming that is killing people. It's not
yes.
listening to their heart. Yeah.
I'm so with you 100%. Yeah. My take is that the only reason we have any kind of suffering in the world is, you know, whether it's starvation or water shortages or divorce or war or whatever, is because the mind is functioning out of some form of hostility or fear that it has no idea how to forgive, just does crazy things, destroys its own body, and destroys the world around it. Hand that same person forgiveness, and they're going to start to move out of those mindsets and change the whole game. So I join you in changing the game, especially in that realm of suicide, for sure.
And one conclusion I came to the other day, these little one-liners come to me, it's like, if you're not living your bliss, then you have failed creation.
You know, I'm with you on that one. I'm
yeah.
Tapping in.
You know, here I am. Yeah, you know. Every doctor I go to see, they're going, they're the ones, the fearful ones, you know. And I'm sitting here thinking, feeling, I don't like doing a lot of thinking, but I'm feeling, well, should I go around and worry, you know, blah, 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 blah. No, that's playing their game. Why would I lower my energetic level, my state of being, that something is inevitable, you know, once this this physical shell has done its job, then I'll just rest for a while and come back in another one. So this is weird, isn't it? It's weird how they use our fear again.
Well, we'll hold the space, my friend.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, and I'll send my brother's contact information to you.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Okay. Holding you to blessing. Appreciate the fact you get up at 4:30 in the morning to hang out with us.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. It's like family, you know. And also, I just love this time of day. You know, it's, nice. The world is still. Okay. No worries, mate.
Delighted to have you as part of our family. All right, my friend. Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that opens a sweet space. Thank you for that conversation.
And I texted you his contact information.
Okay, thank you, sweetheart.
And there are no other hands up. You've got 18 minutes.
Well, let's get started on the end of suffering. So the first chapter is entitled, Who is Yeshua to Me? And the word Yeshua is the actual name of this man that the Greeks called Jesus, Jesus, Hail Zeus. His actual name was Yeshua. And he starts out the conversation saying, you realize they killed me twice. Character response, how is that possible? If someone's been killed, obviously they can't die again. If you understood from my cultural point of view, from my Aramaic mindset, you'd know that my teaching and I are one. I was restored after they killed my body, but since my teaching was hidden by changing the meaning of my words, it has not recovered. My teaching is far more important than my personal self. Far more important than my personal name. Character report. But I've heard preachers over and over again condemn people to hell for not receiving you, for not believing in your name and obeying someone who sure appears to be acting under your authority. Without you, they say, there's no way to make it, that we're all lost, condemned to hell, and you're the only way out. They come up with this question, have you accepted Jesus, as though it is of paramount importance? And yes, response, is there anywhere you've heard me suggest setting people up to feel like outcasts, or worse, failures with such a question? People set themselves up as a special group apart from others with that awful question when people give the quote-unquote wrong answer, they're pounced on with fear, the likes of which I've never seen. I came to teach people to heal fear and separation, the source of untold damage. Unreformed reformers, the very people I came to free from suffering, to free them from the false teachers who use fear, have, to a great degree, taken over my teachings, and in many cases turned my words totally backward. My purpose was to increase people's experience of life, to bring each individual into the direct experience of themselves as love, and inspire them to facilitate that experience in others. He shook his head. Interesting. So many teach the opposite of what I said and use threat and force to get people to accept their interpretation of my words, especially if their pronouncements are rebuffed. But what about going to hell for rejecting you? Have you looked at what I said about someone who rejects me? My declaration on the subject was clear. If any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. It's interesting, just an aside. It's interesting that the false teachers of the day pushed him to judgment of others, and in every case he refused, But you'll notice their doctrine still includes that, well, there's a day of judgment coming and he's going to do it then. He wouldn't do it back before, but now he's going to. It's like, and it's just so silly on its face. So once again, and if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world, to give people the tools for healing. Let them reject me. That's perfectly fine. Do you suppose someone who condemns another to hell in my name, when I, with great deliberation and forethought, sent the same person my blessing, person's functioning in my name? Do you think the person who says the reverse of what I thought knows me? What I taught was a pathway to a sane, serene life based in love. If one does not follow that pathway, who am I to threaten and force them? Threat and force are the tools of darkness. Cloud the minds of those who use them. And the tools one uses always produces a result just like the tools. Make no mistake about it. One who condemns another to hell sentences only themselves. Any form of condemnation is a grave error. Whatever the pious front one puts up, one only condemns so easily because they live in fear and feel condemned themselves. This kind of intimidation has been around forever and is the product of the opposite of what I taught, a fear-based mind. Do you recall what I said? When those who use fear to control the religious of my day tried to trick me into judging and condemning? My rule was, neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. Yes, I did inform people there were certain energies that they would destroy themselves with if they engaged. Energies that were off the mark. To use those very energies rooted in fear to try to force people into obedience was not anything I ever supported. How do I reconcile what I've been taught? You're supposed to be the way, the truth, and the life. If not you, then what is important? How do I figure this out? Again, another aside, this in Aramaic, as Yeshua alluded to in the first couple of thoughts in this chapter, a man and his teaching were one. You remember he says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. You know, if I had a meeting with you tomorrow and it turned out that I couldn't make it and I sent my son, Michael J., in my stead, and you went home to, you know, your spouse, you'd say, I had a meeting with Michael Rice today. You didn't meet with me, you met with my son. But in the Aramaic context, in that cultural context, a man and his son were one. And in exactly the same way, in the Aramaic context, a man and his teaching are one. If you've seen the teaching, you've seen the man. If you've seen the man, then you've seen the teaching. Or at least, I should say, you've been exposed to the teaching, because if the teaching arouses in you something based in hostility or fear, then the construct your mind will present of that teaching will be something based in hostility or fear, unless you first open that gateway, Rachma, to reconnect your mind to the active presence of love. So, I am the way, the truth, and the life is an absolutely true statement. My teaching is the way to get there. If you follow this path, you'll get there. If you don't follow this path, you won't get to the other end of the path. And so, recognize that as a basic principle from the Aramaic. that the man and his teaching were one. So when it says, I am the way, he's not speaking about his own personal ego self. You remember on another occasion, he does refer to his own personal ego self. And he says, if I come in my own name, I'm a false prophet. And false prophets push him all the time and push his name as though that is the key. But that's not Aramaic thinking. That's not the way the Aramaic mind works. So once again, how do I reconcile what I've been taught? You're supposed to be the way, the truth, and the life. If not you, then what is important? How do I figure this out? Fortunately, you do not need to figure it out. Just listen to my words. I've told you how it works, but interpretations that keep you in fear are put on my words. If you want to follow me and someone puts words or meanings into my mouth, but you can't find where I said it, or if it is inconsistent with the first principle, that of love, which I taught, I suggest you consider it suspect. So the basic law is that law of love. Does it come from, does it reflect active present love? If it doesn't, be careful. People often want someone to do their work for them. Someone who claims to be more powerful, one who can rescue them from their own weaknesses, or better yet, save them through some magic incantation. That was not my teaching. In essence, humans resist change and think that if they can just say the right name, they can do anything and hope shouting that name will save them from the consequences of their own behavior. And that's a lie. Excuse me, I'm just making a note. I'll probably pick this book back up and start writing again. I'd actually set it down way back when the publisher's representative I sent it to just totally, you know, ran off. So people think they can do anything and hope that shouting my name will save them from the consequences of their own behavior, and that's just a lie. They say things like, well, just give me a name to call on. Don't make me look at myself or face myself or change. Let me stay the same. Let me go my merry way and you fix it for me. You take care of my life. To them I said, if another shall come in his name, him you'll receive. But they ignored me and shouted all the more, no, it's you who must do this for us. And you hear, unfortunately, much of what's called Christianity today, many of those sects, that's the whole bottom line. There's no obligation for you to do your own work. In fact, often in the name of supposedly his teaching, you're told there's nothing you can do because you're hopeless and helpless. And that's all just part of the error that he came to correct. I cannot do it for you. I did not come for that, but to show you how to heal your own mind. Suffering wears you down and is self-inflicted. I know how to end it, but if you're still suffering, you do not. You must learn what I said, do it, and change yourself. Those who want to keep you in unconsciousness and weakness can't allow you to understand what I said, for in your healing is your power. And you make a better subject when you're powerless. takes responsibility in work. And those who did not want to do the work, who said, just call his name, there's nothing you have to do, nothing you can do, you're just a helpless sinner anyway, I say, many think they know me, yet leave my instructions untied. Have they applied and experienced what I said they could? If not, how could they possibly teach others? Call when I said, I have overcome the world, and he that overcometh shall not be heard of the second death. Note, I did not say, he who lets me overcome the world for him. I meant there was a work to be done. I taught you how to live in this world, but not be of it. And that is the work of self-mastery. I taught the possible, the overcoming life, and because of its difficulty, it has been left untried. Instead, substituting belief for effort and the inner work I demonstrated and instructed people to do. In one case, several of my disciples, when instructed in the work required for healing, left muttering, too hard a saying, and they never returned. People in the art and science of undoing the false self and refraining from the habits, behaviors, addictions, and sensations that accompany that state of mind. I even informed them that the result would be a sort of death, saying that in order for you to live, you have to die. It takes no effort to live in your natural state of love, unless you've lost your true identity. Once that occurs, the effort, the work of forgiving, all the dynamics of the false self and the alluring sensations that accompany living in a lie, all of that which prevents, one from living as love must be faced and dealt with. And we are down to the last few seconds, so we'll pick this up tomorrow and continue. And I'll just say thank you deeply for your listening ears and your participation. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give.